Okay, so today is the 22nd of September 2011. It's Bridget Brownlow interviewing Dr. Terry Murphy. Hello, how
Hello.
Are you doing? Nice to have you here.
Glad to be here.
So we'd like to start. I'd like to start by maybe you could tell me your first memories of being a student here at St. Mary's, what the campus was like, what you remember.
Well, I remember being excited and thinking I was all grown up.
Yeah.
Being quite stimulated and excited by the whole experience. But I also remember the campus being small. In fact, I think the student population was smaller than St. Pat's High.
Okay.
And yet we were all suddenly college boys and thought that was a big leap forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a welcoming and convivial environment, but I do remember the initiation culture, which was pretty brutal.
Really?
I mean, not just for me, and fortunately it didn't involve the kind of binge drinking that's been a problem recently, but you got to remember this was an all-male setting with a very strong sports culture, so there was some public humiliation, which was just good fun, but, you know, being told to go up to women on the street in English Street and propose marriage to them, things like that. But also a lot of physical demands, like push-ups and
okay.
running around the track. And it was probably, him and I survived it well enough, but when I think back, it was over the top and probably some really difficult for some new students. Right?
For sure. And what year was that again that you started?
1965.
65.
I know I don't look that old.
Right. No, you definitely don't look that old.
So that's
shocking.
First weeks, if that's what you were focusing on.
Okay. And so, anything else that comes to mind in those first years in regard to, let's say, the protest culture?
Oh, well, we're jumping ahead now to the last year. There was, I mean, it was the age of civil rights protests and anti-Vietnam campaign. And I would say that the protest culture here was pretty mild. I mean, it was a conservative college, by and large, with a pretty strong disciplinary environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't behaving like Ryerson or Columbia, you know. But there was also, you know, a lot of very engaged students, especially in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember there being a, perhaps not in my first year, but sometime during my time here, there was a lunchtime lecture series, which was called something like the Bear Pit. I can remember in particular Gavin Boyd, who was professor of political science and was reputed anyway to have a background in Australian intelligence. I don't know if that's true or not, but he had written a book on China and Southeast Asia, I think, and was quite conservative and a great supporter of the war. And I can remember him being confronted in the Burke Lecture Theatre when giving these lectures. So it wasn't so much demonstrations or vandalism, but
right.
pretty strongly expressed views and confrontation over things like that. Civil rights, I mean, people were attuned to Martin Luther King
yes.
and the Southern Christian movement, but I don't remember anything in particular around that. You know, it was a very white campus, that's for sure.
Yes.
Some African Americans in the basketball team, as usual,
mm-hmm.
some Caribbean students, but race wasn't a big issue, and I think the Vietnam War was a bigger concern than civil rights. That's my recollection, anyway.
Right, okay. And that certainly matches with the documentation,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. More in the journal.
Yes, yeah. What are some of your memories around the journal?
That it was fairly high quality.
Mm.
There was both the journal and the photo club. And it was located on the third floor of the McNally building. And the faculty advisor for the photo club was a chemistry professor named Alan Sabine.
Oh.
I think it was Alan. And he was a very accomplished amateur photographer. Keith Vaughn is sort of in his tradition, right?
Right.
So there was this independent club, and they provided photographs for the yearbook, which I edited one year, much to my disgrace, and also to the journal, I think. And there was some degree of tension between the yearbook staff, the journal staff, and the photo club, because everybody was a law unto themselves.
Right.
But the journal, both locally written articles, and I just had a memory that I'll come back to, both locally written articles, and there was a wire service, I don't know if that's still active, a Canadian Student Press or something.
It was huge, and the journals I've read.
Yeah, and it was very, very good. And they used to send somebody down to give workshops to the local campus newspaper staff. The memory that just occurred to me, because there was this stuff in the journal about it, was Rocky Jones did come and give one of these talks. And of course, he was one of the leaders of the Great Ryerson protest for the computer. Oh, you don't know about that. So
no.
George Williams. Not Ryerson, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said Ryerson earlier either. It was Concordia.
Concordia. Well, tell me about that.
And at Sir George, there was a protest that was partly about race, I think. I mean, you have to go back and read the history, but it was the days of computer cards that stored data, and they, as I recall, they threw them from an upper story window onto the street and destroyed all kinds of records and so on. I forget the story, but Rocky Jones was, even as a student, he was at Dow Law School when he came to speak here, but he had become famous at Concordia, at Sir George, as it was.
Sir George. Okay.
And so I remember, you know, the question of black power and so on being an issue, at least when he was on campus talking about it.
Right.
Sometime around that period, too, Stokely Carmichael visited Rocky and others in Halifax. And I know some of these stories from Jim Walker, who's white but a historian of Caribbean migration too.
Okay.
He was here a couple of years ago, sponsored by the Metropolis Center in Atlantic Canada Studies. And
I remember
Jim Morrison
that.
Is a good friend of his, yeah. But he was driving Stokely Carmichael. Anyway, I'm rambling.
Well,
like,
no,
I'm
that's fascinating.
Like, yeah.
So that and that really helps to see what types of, you know, lectures or talks were taking place, because the evidence is supportive of what you said, in that it was a very mild protest culture here.
Yeah.
But can you help me understand how the Jesuits may have looked at the protest culture? What you?
Probably with some caution. I mean, not undue alarm, you know,
right.
But a measure of caution, because, you know, campuses were in an uproar elsewhere.
Mm.
I think probably any university administration was a little anxious that they would have similar incidents. But they didn't have much to worry about, and I don't think they worried about it too much. If they did, I wasn't aware of it.
And what were you wearing to class in the years you were here? I'm really interested in that.
Ties and jackets.
And jackets.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely required. There used to be some comedians who would come from the residence with a tie and no shirt, and, you know, maybe an undershirt and a tie and a jacket, but the strict rule was you had to have a tie and a jacket, didn't say anything but a shirt. And Father O'Donnell, going back many years, he taught me Latin, and he was in his final years as a teacher when I was here, but he'd been the dean of men, and he was nicknamed Bucky. Because if he caught you anywhere other than the gym corridor without a tie on, he fined you a dollar. So he was affectionately known as Bucky O'Donnell.
And so you, during your time, or so 65, let's go up to 68. By 68, had there been a change in
clothing?
Not in the
dress code. No,
really?
No. No, the basement corridor of McNally, Maine, was the gym corridor. The gym is where McNally East was.
Yes.
Below the church.
Right.
Which meant you could hear basketballs bouncing during the And the area where the print shop is was the locker room.
Oh.
And day students had lockers. It was a bit like high school.
Right.
And we all kept jackets in those lockers and would, you know, come to school, take our winter clothing, if it was winter clothing, off and put our coats and ties on, but you couldn't leave that corridor without a coat and tie, or you were disciplined.
Wow.
And, you know, it wasn't so bad.
Something nice about a uniform sometimes, you know, in
that
sense.
Yeah, and there wasn't an official uniform, but I think a lot of guys did wear maroon blazers with St. Mary's crests on them, just as a matter of choice, but it wasn't a prescribed uniform. But it created a kind of business-like environment in class, I think.
Yes.
And it was a bit of a male culture, and that kind of reinforced that in a funny way, you know, the
Absolutely.
business dress, you know.
Yeah. In one of the journal articles, it was described St. Mary's attire, student attire, akin to a British grammar school.
Yeah, well, that would be a bit of an exaggeration because British Grammar School would have the actual
Uniform.
uniform and the school tie. There was the St. Mary's tie as there is now, but that wasn't required either.
Right.
And we certainly didn't wear short pants with our jackets.
Right. Okay, so that so in
Or
terms of
beanies.
attire, or right, or beads, that's right, that's right. Okay, let's look then now at secularization. So I'm interested in any thoughts or connections you might have between Vatican II and secularization at St. Mary's.
That's a good historical question, which I should work on sometime. I think Vatican II seemed hugely revolutionary at the time. You know, I mean, while other campuses maybe were promoting Marxist-Leninist views and protest culture and the radical politics were much more defined than here, there was, within the limits of progressive Catholicism, a tremendous sense of liberation and change and innovation and modernization. So it created a much more open atmosphere. And I think, at least indirectly, that culture that came out of Vatican II, which was really much more liberal-minded then than I think current Catholicism is in a way, you know,
Interesting, yeah.
probably served to phase out the mentality that had lasted for more than a century at least of separate religio-ethnic institutions to protect the integrity and the persistence of Catholic observance and Catholic belief. There was much less fear of openness to the rest of the world.
Interesting.
And that was largely the message of Vatican II, was an aggiornamento, you know,
Right.
an updating and openness to the secular world and certainly to other faiths, at least to other
Right.
Christian denominations. So I think it was a mindset that contributed, and I don't think there was a kind of cause and effect link in the sense that you could trace it in documentary terms or directives from one church authority to another, but the mindset changed dramatically.
That's interesting. Now, would you have been aware as a student at the time of any of the, that was the period that you were here as a student was a period of intense negotiations between St. Mary's and the Mount. Would you have been aware of any of that
Yeah,
or?
we probably were misinformed,
Right.
but we had lots of rumors and lots of talk about it, yeah. And part of it was, you know, the move to admit women to St. Mary's was perceived by the Mount, or we perceived the Mount to perceive it as a threat, and I think
Yes.
they probably did, yeah.
Yeah.
What was really going on in the confidential negotiations, we had no clue, but we realized it was an issue, and it was all tied up with the question of whether women would be admitted to the regular programming at St. Mary's.
And now, would that have been, if you can recollect, in your first couple of years, would that have been on your radar, or was that more towards the end of your
Towards
time?
the end, yeah. I was only
Okay.
here 3 years, remember,
Right.
because in those
Yes.
days, if you had grade 12 with strong grades, you did a 3-year BA, right?
Right.
Which was, I think, different from most of Canada. It was a kind of British tradition, you know? And there were students, including some of my classmates from high school, who came after grade 11 and did 4 years of university. But I'm digressing.
Right, no, that's
But in my first year, I don't remember that emerging as an issue, and I wouldn't have been as attuned to the student politicians, because, you know, I was a freshman and was worried about keeping my scholarship
okay. Right.
for most of my time in the library. I got over that after about a year. But I think my first year experience was quite a bit different than year two and three, and I emerged, and I was never on the student council, I can remember, but I was active at meetings and editing the yearbook and, you know.
Various other
Yeah.
activities, right.
Yeah. I was involved.
Yeah.
But I remember the issue of co-education and so on emerging mostly in my final year.
Okay. And
I
what
won't say it didn't emerge on the horizon even in my second year, but it was much more prominent in 67, 68.
Yes, it only starts to appear in the journal really in 67.
Yeah.
That's
so
when.
that's, yeah.
So what are your memories around that? Around the talk on campus?
Yeah.
Your friends?
Yeah.
Your own?
Well, what I remember is the division of opinion. I mean, part of the reality, and this doesn't coincide exactly with the division on that issue, but I think one of the salient features of St. Mary's in those days was the distinction, which probably exists in another form now, the distinction between day students, so-called day hops,
mm-hmm.
and resident students.
Yeah.
And the day students were overwhelmingly local kids, mostly from St. Pat's and
right.
so on. And the resident students, not exclusively, but to a large extent, were out of province and even out of country, American students, Ontario students. And there were others. I remember having friends from distant Porter's Lake, you know,
yeah.
who had to live in residence because the commute was too far, and from Cape Breton and so on. But
right.
but there was a pretty sharp distinction between the local students and the resident students. And, you know, mild tension, I would say. The local students were local yokels in the perception of the resident students, and the resident students were exotic,
yeah, right.
you know, Americans with all the latest styles and attitudes and stuff. So that was an
interesting.
Division. And I think that among the resident students, there was probably a, this wouldn't be universal, and this is not a scientific observation,
mm-hmm.
but I think there would have been more opposition to the admission of women among those who lived here. Because it was a, you know, quite a all-embracing culture of
mm-hmm.
of a boarding school,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even
mm-hmm.
those who lived here in their first years and moved off campus. I mean, St. Mary's was their home in Halifax, right? And they, some of them at least, valued the kind of male camaraderie that seemed to be threatened by the admission of women to the club. You know?
I've heard it described as Notre Dame without the chicks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I would have thought that people like, you know, and you and I have talked about this without a tape recorder, but
yeah.
people like Father Hennessy were very supportive of that culture.
Yes.
And probably not very happy about the change.
That's come through in other interviews, yes.
Yeah.
yeah.
And so it was, I would be certainly exaggerating if I said the lines of division were between
mm.
residents and day students, but I mentioned that distinction because that was one of the salient realities of coming
mm-hmm.
here as a local student,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then there was certainly a division of opinion about
mm-hmm.
whether women should be admitted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the majority were in favor.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the very articulate student leaders like Bob Shaw were certainly campaigning for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some prominent guys on campus, and I hope I didn't get sued or liable for saying this, but I, my recollection is that Skip Oliver, who
mm-hmm.
was a very prominent guy
yeah.
and big man on campus, as we used to say, was opposed to it. That's my memory, anyway.
Now he
don't sue me, Skip.
Yes, no. no, he doesn't come through. There is some opposition that comes out in the journal, and I'd have to go back and look again to see, but that was noted. The
yeah.
And say, for instance, Larry Hood was
yeah.
open about his
opposition.
Resistance and
yeah.
opposition. Yeah.
Speaking of Cape Bretoners who lived in residence. Right,
right
yeah.
that's right.
Yeah.
And this division between day and day hops and resident students also I found manifested in areas of other protests that were happening on campus. So
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
residents guys didn't like it when the day guys were protesting against the food because they had to stay here and eat it.
Right.
And the day guys were heading home
right.
for supper.
Right. Right. Back to mother's
cooking. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's it. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So, the majority would have been in favor. Those who did you have a sense of why they were opposed? Was it just to keep this sort of male Notre
yeah.
Dame type?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Keep the male. Mike Larson speculated in the interview I did with him that resistance to co-education, let me think here, oh, I'll go back to that, I'm losing my train of thought there, sorry. So okay, so most of was just to keep this all male sort of institution. In what ways would you have seen that manifest itself?
The opinion or the
yeah,
yeah.
the opinion of
just
resistance.
Very vocal discussions in the common room or student center as
right.
it became.
Okay.
And probably in the journal, you know, but a
Okay.
lot of conversations and arguments over coffee and.
And we've talked about this elusive protest in the spring of
Yeah, in the
68.
spring of 68, which at least I'm not sure took place.
Yes. Oh, it definitely took place.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about what you do remember about that?
My memories are kind of episodic.
Yes, that's great.
I
That's
remember
fine.
students gathering in the gym and a number of us speaking about the issue and how we had to make our feelings known. And part of what I remember about that, and again, I hope I don't get sued, but the late Rick Minicello, who was another prominent figure on campus, a guy from the Boston area, who was a mainstay of the drama club and a very talented actor,
Oh.
but a bit of a wild man,
Yes.
and had the kind of personality when there was an opportunity to make a demagogic speech, he wouldn't miss it, and he was up on the stage firing people up for something a little bit more aggressive than we had in mind. And I can remember coming behind him and contradicting him and being threatened by, because you know I.
Was he pro or con?
Oh, he was just in favor of a protest anyhow. But he was
Very dramatic.
He was supporting the idea of co-education. But I mean, I think he was more into the rabble rousing than anything else. And he was a very charismatic character.
Right.
But I think in my own conservative way, I was getting alarmed that it was going to get out of hand if he got sway of the crowd. Don't think there was as much danger of that as I imagined, but I do remember opposing him from the stage, you know, and saying that we had to go about this in an orderly fashion, which puts me right in that character of mild protesters. And then my memory, which I hope isn't invented, is of us gathering in the fairly recently built student center. And
So we
protesting
moved
by,
from over, you
yeah,
moved
we were
across
over,
to here?
yeah, we were, I don't think the whole student center was built, I think
Okay.
some floors, but
Yeah.
Again, at the risk of inventing memories, my mental image is of being on the first floor in a cafeteria setting, not as modern as the current one, but
Yes.
something like that. And the strategy was that we would not go to class. I don't remember any big march, or it might have been, but I remember more the scene in the student center. And I thought that we had been coached to have our picture taken while we appeared to study, so that we would be seen as very responsible student protesters who
Protesting yet studying.
weren't going to class,
Right.
but keeping
Yeah.
up with our books, you know?
That's so
And
sweet.
my recollection again is that a Jesuit named Bob McDougall, who had a background in communications and PR, was the one who coached us to do that. And he was an interesting character.
Interesting.
But every time I tell this story, I'm afraid that I'm conflating a couple of different memories or, you know.
Well,
Don't know.
you are the only one that we've been able to find who can even cite the story. So it's really, it's quite interesting because there's nothing else in any of the other available documentation that speaks to this. And I think I know why, I figured out why, but.
Strange. Well, the other memory I have is Laurie Smith was the director of student services, or whatever it was called. He had been my vice principal at St. Pat's, and I came here as director of student services. And Bob Shaw and I went into his office, and he was talking about how to resolve and get the students back to class. How do we do this? And of course, Bob and I were both conservative, and I had no official position. I was just a Budinsky, I think. Bob was the president of the student council. So there was a discussion about how to end the strike.
How long would it have
And,
gone on for?
oh, a very short time, a day or two.
Just a day or two, right,
Yeah,
I was going to say.
but I mean, as soon as it had taken shape, it was then Laurie Smith's job to see how to bring it to conclusion. Now, I can remember, and I shouldn't confess this, being kind of wound up and hyper and talking too much, and Laurie Smith saying, why don't you leave Bob and I alone, and, you know, I'll talk to the president. I was politely dismissed, because I wouldn't shut up. And I also remember the president, who was Father Lavelle, Henry Lavelle, talking to the students, I think again in the gym, and when I picture it,
You can visualize the gym.
Yeah, and I make these things up all the time,
Yeah.
but I remember sitting in bleachers and him telling us in so many words that the bishop had agreed in principle to make the change.
Yes.
But that we should go back to class and it would take care of itself.
And
I think
fits.
That worked.
Yeah, that fits with the documentation.
Does it?
Yeah,
Okay.
it does.
And I remember somebody saying, why don't you tell us, you know, what's going to happen? Because he was being a bit oblique.
Right.
And again, I think it was David Piggott who taught English, saying if you'd been listening carefully, he just did tell you what was going on.
Right, right. Sort of read between the lines.
I think that took us all back to class.
Right, okay. Okay. Interesting. Do you recall a professor that was here named Sarabia? Sarabia?
Well, there was a Jesuit who was Cuban.
Right, I think we talked about him before,
and
yes.
I'm not sure whether I meant to look that up for you, whether
right.
that's the same person
okay.
you're talking about, but it could be.
And the other protest that featured, now it would have been the year after, I think, 69, was...
Keith Sutherland.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember about that.
Right, okay. You
and
would have heard about that.
There was a kind that. Of protest culture. Yeah, I mean, I went away to graduate school and came back in the spring and actually taught here, which is a scary thought, after 1 year of graduate school. So I was still very much in touch with
what was
going on here.
Well, I forgot to get those details from you again. You went to graduate school. Where did you do your graduate and PhD?
Fordham. No, I didn't do my PhD though. I did an MA.
An
I started a PhD and then transferred to Newcastle.
Okay.
Fordham was a Jesuit university in the Bronx.
Right.
Still is.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I mean, New York was a bit overwhelming for a local yokel from
Halifax
to just get off the boat literally and be thrown into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was certainly a big change. Fordham was a good school.
Yes.
Huge graduate student contingent of graduate students in theology, as it was called then.
Yeah.
And that was closely related to the Vatican II and the
right.
excitement.
An exciting time for
yeah.
you to have.
Yeah, and a lot of nuns and priests, but a lot of lay students like
mm-hmm.
myself too. I think there were, you counted the part-time graduate students, there might have been 150 of us.
Interesting, wow.
And there was an entire faculty for the graduate studies only, and then an undergraduate theology department at the downtown campus. So there was, you know, perhaps a dozen or 14 professors who did nothing but teach grad students.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now,
it was a big operation.
Yeah. Now, in the 69 and 70 yearbooks, LaBelle writes, you know, his letter to the graduates,
mm-hmm.
and it's very prophetic. I mean, he's sort of referencing Vatican II, he's referencing women coming and everything. What was, and then I've heard in various other interviews that he was really quite traumatized by the amount of, you know,
backlash
and just really was quite difficult for him.
Yeah.
Do you remember him or what
oh,
he was
yeah.
like? Or?
Oh yeah, a very gentlemanly, elegant sort of guy. As I recall, his discipline was probably philosophy, although I don't remember him as a teacher.
Right.
But he was a very thoughtful, very, you know, I was going to say a man's man, but not in the sense of being particularly strong or physically imposing,
mm-hmm.
but just his, you know, a well-educated,
mm-hmm.
rather elegant, refined gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I remember him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him being friends with Bob Stanfield, too, who
mm.
lived in the Oaks in those days. That was his family home in Halifax, being controller, of course. And I think LaBelle used to regularly play crib with him over there.
Really?
So he moved comfortably in those circles, you know.
Okay.
Jesuits were kind of gentlemen clerics anyway, and
right.
when I went to Fordham, it was the same thing. They
yes.
were sophisticated, cosmopolitan. Almost all of them had at least another language besides the classical languages. They had years of education,
right.
part of it in the, usually in another country or continent. So
right.
LaBelle was very much that type.
Was he okay?
Yeah, but not condescending or snobbish.
Mm-hmm.
I quite liked him
mm-hmm.
for
mm-hmm.
the extent to which a student had contact with him.
He was here during a very difficult time.
Yeah, and then of course he made a change in his life too by
right.
getting married, and we still joke about Father LaBelle's wife.
Now, would you have been, others interviewed have commented on, there would have been a sense even for the Jesuits that the time had come where they could get married, and this was, and
yeah,
sort
yeah.
of led
well,
to a lot leaving.
Yeah, and a lot of diocesan priests too. I mean, it was a very
Right.
difficult time for the Archbishop, because a lot of his clergy were leaving,
Yes.
and he himself, of course, is a hugely well-educated and sophisticated person. But I think he had a very difficult time, and I think that St. Mary's and the unrest about coeducation and other things played into that. That I'm not sure that he just didn't decide he'd had enough of this, and that, you know, the diocese trying to manage this college, and they'd had, over the history of the university, there had been tensions between the bishop and the religious orders, like especially the Christian Brothers who came in to run it, and then there was a falling out, and there'd been controversy between the bishop or archbishop and the laity over the funding and, you know, the money being taken. I checked with my sister about the basement churches, and my memory of that was correct,
Yes.
except that the reason I gave, the initial reason she said was that after the war, there just wasn't enough money. It wasn't because Bishop McNally took the money for the college initially.
Right.
There just was only enough money to get started, so they got started, and as they raised money, they completed the projects. But in the middle of that process, he did take money, and that was deeply resented. And I, from my own family, was an example. There was a very ambivalent attitude towards the college. On the one hand, resentment that the money had been taken, especially for a South End campus. On the other hand, a lot of pride because this new college was kind of a symbol of the aspirations of the Irish Catholic community, who had been the, you know, overwhelmingly working class. And so they'd had the college before, but a brand spanking new building, you know, that on a nice campus was. So they didn't know whether to love it or hate it, you know. But in that, that's part of the, I think, of the broad context for the bishop's tribulations. You know, he had a history of tribulations from previous bishops, and then, you know, I don't know what the relationship between him and the Jesuits was, and the terms of the contract, and whether there were tensions there. I just don't know,
It would be a
but there could have
fascinating
been.
area to
Could
study.
have been. And then the, you know, students clamoring for co-education, and perhaps the Sisters of Charity lobbying against it, and I think in some ways he just had enough.
And in fact, almost that is almost quoted exactly from maybe it was Larry Murphy or Stewart in oral history interviews from 93 who
Oh, is
said
that it?
that. They said that almost exactly that.
Oh, isn't
You
that
know, he'd had
interesting?
enough. He's washed his hands of it and said, I'm not dealing with this university anymore. Just can't.
So I don't know if I absorbed that from other conversations years ago that I forget, or whether it was my own independent impression, but I'll take credit
Yeah,
for it
right, you
if
can
I
take credit for it. Oh, it makes sense. You know, it would have been a huge.
And I mean, he really did, he lived through a period of real crisis that, you know, the adjustment, in retrospect, Vatican II seems almost quaint compared to some of the political changes that have occurred in the world, but or and also the religious changes that come with mass immigration and globalization. But if you put yourself back in those days, it was pretty heady and pretty both exhilarating and confusing. Rapid
Absolutely.
change from a world that seemed not just stable but almost eternal.
The student perspective of secularization was almost non-existent. So there's very little, maybe one or two articles in all those years in the journal
Sorry.
around secularization.
Co-education was the issue.
Coeducation was the issue. Barely anyone seemed to notice that the university had gone secular.
And I don't know how much. I mean, I guess the change was incremental. So in the daily life of a student, it didn't necessarily make a huge difference. I mean, you didn't have to go to mass anymore. Some people did, but you didn't have to. In the old days, you probably had to say the rosary at night too, you know. So there was no supervision of students' religious lives, no prescription about, you know, testifying that you believed in this, that, or the other thing. So in the daily life of a student, it probably didn't make much difference, especially because Jesuit professors stayed, you know. They had dwindled in number by natural attrition and through the expansion of the college, but they didn't disappear when the secularization occurred. And people like Father Murphy, the chemist, and Larry Murphy, the theologian, I mean, stayed on for quite some time. So I think co-education was a much bigger issue, but and they weren't identical, but they were linked. And And then there would have been negotiations that we weren't privy to about the financial aspects of St. Mary's taking out a mortgage and buying itself from the diocese. And I don't know whether the diocese had financial motives for the deal, but I doubt it in those days. I think their pews are still
quite
well populated and church collections a lot healthier than they would be now. So I don't know, but I don't think it was really motivated by a desire to. A lot of properties were sold, though. I mean, the Quinfield Center
was
all diocesan property and was sold. So
the Good Shepherd and
and the Holy Heart Seminary, you know. And I don't know whether they were sold because the money was needed, or they were sold because they were so underutilized that they couldn't justify it anymore. Just don't know. A lot of things I don't know.
But you know a lot, too. You do. Yeah, because Mike Larson, I mean, that was, I guess that was one of his points, was that the impact of secularization is was probably more deeply felt by the greater community than it was.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if there was backlash, my guess is that some of it would have come from the alumni.
Right.
And when Mike Larson, you know, telling secrets now, but when he became dean, I was in that competition and was unsuccessful. And I can remember being asked in the interview by Ken Osmond, you know, what view I would take of the Catholic character. And my answer was something like, you know, that there was a historical reality, but that I thought that previously religious institutions like St. Mary's had morphed into havens for liberal studies and liberal education.
Yes.
And that in that way they kind of preserved the tradition, emphasis on humane studies. I don't think that answer was satisfactory. I think that I should have been more attuned to the sentiments of the alumni who were very faithful to the tradition of the Catholic college. They may not have been the most faithful Catholics, but they still like the tradition.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And so the admission of women and the secularization might have elicited more backlash from alumni than from current students by far.
Right. Oh, that makes sense,
and,
doesn't
and,
it?
And the community, you know, who felt a certain ownership. Maybe it was they made the sacrifices in the first place to build it, and now it appeared to be stripped, and they probably wouldn't have had much information about the financial terms of the deal.
And you know, it's so funny how, you know, things just, so I look back, you know, some of the pictures in the yearbooks in 69, 70, those years particularly, there's all kinds of pictures of naked women in there, and you know, really, you
don't
have a chance. It's so by even if you look and by today's standards, you wouldn't get away with that today.
Yes, it was post-Catholic, pre-feminist.
Right. That's exactly it.
There was a controversy. There was a controversy, and I don't think it started at St. Mary's, but over a special issue of, might have been Acadia.
Jim might know about that.
Yeah, there was the recent one, you know, the girls of St. Mary's, the student. Yeah.
Right.
And this was a special issue of a student newspaper, and I think Acadia did it first. And did St. Mary's imitate it, or did they just defend the freedom of the press, as it were? But there was a hell of a fuss in the 60s about, and
well,
you know,
have to check that out.
Sandra, my wife, might remember, but they weren't naked, but they were provocative.
Right. Well, yeah, it's quite shocking. I mean, and things around alcohol, as you pointed out earlier on, that the amount of drinking-related activities and things going on, you know, by today's standards, would never be accepted in.
Yeah, I mean, not that there wasn't drinking. And I can remember, too, a great controversy about seven women, young women who were, we would call them girls then, who were expelled from that. And they had been at a party with St. Mary's guys who had an off-campus residence, and it got late, and they were, you know, drinking and partying, and they stayed overnight instead of getting back to their dorm and meeting their curfew, and they were actually expelled.
Wow.
And they were known in a way that I'm not particularly proud of, but they were known as the Magnificent Seven.
Well, Anne McGilvery, I've interviewed Anne McGilvery, and she said that it was only 15 years ago that the Mount would even allow your father, your brother, a male relative to come up and help you move your bags into.
Yeah.
So the strict regulations at the Mount, wow.
Yeah, you didn't get past the door of Evaristus Hall.
Okay. Well, I know we're running short on time
Yeah.
and we could probably talk for much longer, but I'm very grateful for what you've shared. And this is
Well,
a great contribution.
it's fun to talk about it, but it raises all kinds of questions in my own mind and frustrations about being unsure of my memories, you know, and it makes me want to go back to the sources myself and get the story straight. And I probably have told you all kinds of misleading things,
Well,
too.
no, I think much of what you said is validated by other interviews and the documentation, and it's very, very helpful.
I must
Yeah.
get together with Mike Larson and see if between the two of us we have one brain left.
That's right. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you
And
for the interest.
yeah, very grateful. And I'll end it now.